You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
American society has become increasingly divided, with people sorting themselves into like-minded groups, othering those who disagree, and siloing themselves from opposing viewpoints. The good news is that people are more complex than the labels we assign to them. Today, we'll explore tools for fearless curiosity, leading to empathetic conversations across ideological lines, with our guest, Monica Guzman. Monica Guzman is a journalist and entrepreneur and is the director of digital and storytelling at Braver Angels, a grassroots cross-partisan organization working to depolarize America. She's co-founder of the newsletter The Evergrey out of Seattle, Washington, and is a proud liberal daughter of conservative parents and is a dual U.S.-Mexican citizen. She's the author of I Never Thought of It That Way, How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. So please join us for the next hour as we explore a toolkit for sensible and enlightening conversations across ideological differences with our guest, Monica Guzman. I'm speaking with Monica at her home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Monica, welcome.
Hey, how's it going? Good to see you.
Oh, it's going fine. It's going fine. And I'm really excited to be with you. And I would love to start, and I know many interviews start this way with you, but it's really important to understand how you became interested in pursuing productive conversations across these political divides. And I know you made assumptions, I think mostly in high school, about the politics of your parents. Please share with us your story.
Yes, that's a big part of it. I am from a politically divided family. We're all Mexican immigrants. We came over from Mexico when I was about 6 years old, became citizens when I was 17, and then immediately went two different ways on the political parties in every election since. It got really heated in the 2016 presidential election, as I know it did for a lot of families all across the country. And that was the real test. But it really did start middle school, high school, going to the movies, seeing Michael Moore documentaries, just the arguments we used to have the morning after Glenn Beck said, who knows what, or Rachel Maddow said, who knows what, and, you know, fireworks. But it did really test our expectations of each other. It tested our patience, and it tested our ability to understand before we jumped to conclusions or judged, which of course we still do. I mean, there's plenty of judgment to go around in politics, and some of it is quite healthy. The difference is, You know, are you sufficiently curious enough to try to get to the bottom of why people believe what they believe through a question I find very powerful, which is, how did you come to believe what you believe? Trying to get people's stories. And boy, did that help me understand my parents' political opinions, and it helped them understand mine.
I think you have said that in understanding that, you actually empathize so much with them that you could really, truly say, wow, if I grew up that way, I would feel that too. Am I getting that correct?
That's right. That's a sentence in the introduction of my book that while I was drafting the book, I erased and rewrote, and I erased and wrote it again, and I erased and said, can I actually say this? This seems wild, but I knew it was true. Which was that because they went Republican and I went Democrat, the sentence was, you know, that I realized that if I were my parents, I would have voted for Trump too. And to have gotten to that place meant, I mean, it was a long journey of a lot of conversations where we really did question our assumptions long enough to hear out the other. And I will confess that while both my parents and I, you know, had our own agitations about the other's political beliefs, I think it is fair to say, and my parents would totally agree, that I was the one who was more agitated about their beliefs.
Oh, my. And when you do say something like, well, I understand this political viewpoint, that there are those within our own constituents or the people who believe what we do, that would say, oh, you're really a bad person. How can you even think about that? And they ostracize you or they sever their relationship with you. Has that occurred for you?
I mean, the truth is that I don't know. My guess is that at the edges of my circle, there probably are folks who have ghosted me, and I may not even have realized that that might have been the reason why. I'll tell you, I was very afraid of that happening when I wrote the book, when I published it. Every time that I, from here in Seattle, Washington, which is a very Democratic, liberal-leaning place, and again, those are my views as well, but every time I end up being me, having done this bridge-building work, which often means being the one to throw in the complicating question when there's many liberals who all mostly agree with each other, being the one to go, well, you know, here's what I've heard from conservatives and Republicans that may, you know, make what you just said sound maybe like not the best grounds for the kind of judgment you're giving. I'm always a little bit afraid that there's going to be some blowback. Yeah. I think because I've done it so much with relatively little blowback, I think I'm learning that it's was never as dangerous as I thought it would be.
Monica, I want to say in delving into your book, my personal experience has been with a family member, my own family member, that I have been estranged from for some years, not a whole lot of years, maybe 3 or 4 years. And it was because of his political beliefs. And I just couldn't hold them. And then reading your book, I must say, it made me consider, do I even know his beliefs? Have I asked him any question about what his beliefs are? I just made all these assumptions. Now I'm in dialogue with him.
Wow.
And it's not easy. It's not easy. I know he wrote to me about, he said, and this is a direct quote, I think it's a lot of work to analyze everything to the depth that you do. So let's talk about the conditions for these dialogues, such as I know that, first of all, you say we need to have a time and place.
Yes, I talk about the conditions under which you can have the conversations that are most likely to be productive when you are across divides and disagreement and often the suspicion that comes with it. So it's a time and place, and it's some other things as well. And just to go through the list very quickly, one quality that you want to make sure shows up is embodiment. That means, are you just doing this over text where all you have is words and the occasional emoji? Because here's what happens over text. If you and I are not real sure about each other or each other's intentions in the moment, then something that I write in text, and I write it in a neutral or even kind way, you will read in your own voice that you have projected onto me, which is a mean voice, you know, and I won't be able to see that or control that. So try to make sure that you are in these places where you're bringing the fuller toolbox of human communication to bear, like your expressions and your voice and the good faith that comes across when you smile at each other, you know, in the middle of an argument. Then there is attention. You do want to make sure that you have each other's attention. Now, on Zoom or these, you know, digital platforms, even then, if any of you have had the experience, those of you listening, of being online with someone and it's a Zoom call, and all of a sudden the other person's face gets really bright. Maybe they just opened another tab on their web browser that just got really bright, and they're listening to you, but clearly they're looking something up and they're not even telling. So even then, you don't really know if you have their attention. So here again, in person is the best context to be in, but at least try to, you know, be in synchronous conversation on the phone or on video chat rather than, say, asynchronous on text where, for all you know, they're, you know, I don't know, in the bathroom. Like, you don't know.
Exactly.
Exactly. And then I'll mention one more, which is containment. Containment is really important. It's asking yourself, to what degree is the conversation I want to start or the one that I find myself in that can be a little fiery here and important, to what degree is this conversation contained to the people actually engaging in it? And this is where social media comes in, because on Facebook and a lot of these platforms, you will have people listening, witnessing the exchange of comments who are not themselves commenting and may not themselves even really know what you're commenting about, but they become these sort of silent witnesses. And what happens, of course, is as we consider who might be listening, but we don't actually know and we can't witness their listening, we start to sort of censor ourselves and we start to perform. So if there's a group that we feel, man, we got to make sure that, you know, these folks don't judge me for what I'm about to say. Sometimes we feel like we ought to score points with each other. But boy, the internet is a non-place that makes us into non-people. It's often easier to be finding a time and a place that is contained, where we are all fully present, and people can get more candid that way.
There's needing to be a kind of feeling of safety for people to get beyond performing and just sort of fleshing out their own viewpoint or the assumptions they're making, but to be able to enter the conversation in a open way that they're really listening to one another. And that's one of the conditions also has to do with curiosity, right?
Absolutely. Curiosity is by far the biggest theme of the, you know, the strategies I recommend or the grounds for reflection of how exactly are we coming into these conversations. Very often we come in wanting to win. Very often we come in terrified to be wrong. And both of those things can really jeopardize a constructive, curious conversation across divides. And the only way a conversation can be constructive is if it's curious, because in this type of division, as I like to say, we're so divided, we're blinded. And we are not having honest disagreements. We tend to presume that the disagreement is over something much worse than it actually is.
Right.
And all of these things. And so the only way to check those projections that come from, you know, wherever, the media, our own imagination, which is quite vivid these days, the only way to check those assumptions with reality is to get close enough to other people who genuinely hold different perspectives to even see what's really going on.
Exactly.
And honest disagreement is a precursor for anything constructive.
Oh my goodness. Okay, honest disagreement. I want to ask you, what are your recommendations to find our own biases and our own assumptions that we're bringing to the conversation? We need to know that as well as others and what they're believing so that we can have really great dialogues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing is to pay attention to your reactions. Pay attention in particular to emotional reactions. Now, the only person who can really witness that is you, because I'll tell you, for example, when I'm angry, you know, I don't like fly off the handle. A lot of times when I'm angry, I'll just I'll just become still as a stone. You know what I mean? So that's the way sometimes I become angry. But what happens when I become angry and when I notice it is it becomes an opportunity to look within and to go, okay, what's going on? What are you angry about? And oftentimes I'll realize in the midst of a conversation where anger has come up that I'm angry because of a belief I hold. Okay, well, what is that belief? And oftentimes that belief is tied up with projections and assumptions I'm making. Because that person just said that thing, and that must mean that they believe this thing, which also means that they're probably really terrible. And it's like, whoa, slow your roll. Like, so you believe this, which you think means this, and you think means that. Hang on. At each step is a probability and an uncertainty. And curiosity only survives in conditions of uncertainty. So this is great. This is an opportunity. So when I notice, you know, that kind of thing, I'm angry or I'm feeling disrespected or I'm feeling, I don't know, confounded and frustrated. Each of those is like, okay, what's going on? And sometimes you might find assumptions at the bottom of that. And the key is to turn an assumption into a question. You know, they said that because they believe this awful thing becomes, did they say that because they believe this awful thing? And as soon as you turn that into a question in your head, then you have a new path forward in the conversation. And you can actually go and kind of check that out, you know, like a good journalist, like a good investigator. Just, you know, tell me more about that statement you just said, or I want to hear more about this particular piece. And you could even be honest and say, hey, I got to tell you what, you know, that what you just said raised a lot of red flags for me, but I'm curious what you mean by. So all of these become opportunities to check your assumptions with the reality.
And I'm just thinking that there's a quote that I think I picked up from some of your media. Mm-hmm. And that was, we don't see with our eyes, we see with our whole biography. And that's what you're talking about. It's like feeling it inside ourselves, the emotion that we're feeling and the strong, especially if it's a strong reaction.
Yeah, for sure. Because our emotional reactions are as unique as a fingerprint. You know, the kinds of things that are going to spark me, trigger me, to use one word, are very different than anyone else. And what tends to shape that is the experiences that I've had walking through the world, the things I've seen, the consequences I've seen to those things, the values that I've seen affirmed and challenged, and how those tend to kind of stack up against like the challenges of the world, all this stuff. And so yes, we don't see with our eyes, we see with our whole biographies. And when we really understand that, it becomes easier to see the link between someone's political convictions and their story. And so it means that understanding their story, who they are, where they come from, what they've experienced, what they've seen, and what they've interpreted from the world becomes a way of understanding their political beliefs. A lot of times we tend to skip all that. And we think people hold their political beliefs because of some internal like goodness or badness of themselves or something, you know, because we're so righteous and we think our political beliefs are the only good ones or whatever, which is, you know, itself pretty problematic. So once we understand that people's experiences really are the roots of their opinions, then their opinions become this sort of opportunity to kind of excavate and learn. And as you do that, you also inevitably end up understanding yourself and your story and how it led you to your opinions even more.
So true. So true. I so agree with that. And I know that you say the goal is about understanding rather than victory, you know.
Yes.
And as we talk, so often we're hearing somebody's viewpoint and then we're just waiting to rebut it.
Right.
And we want to say, oh yeah, but, and give our own. But the kind of conversation you're talking about is deeper and more rich than that. Is that right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Because again, if it's true that we see not with just our eyes, but our whole biographies, that means that when you ask someone about their political opinions, you're really tapping into all of the meaning that has coursed through this person's life. And when you mock it, laugh at it, dismiss it, condescend to it, you are dismissing and mocking and condescending to this human being. So listening when we're just waiting for our turn to speak isn't the right way, isn't the best way, I should say. And look, I mess up on this all the time. It's not like I'm like, all the time, like yesterday. But really listening is about showing other people they matter. And when you listen like that, really open, really curious, knowing that whatever idea they happen to hold, this person is more than an idea. It's more than one opinion. Who is this person? I'm here with this person. There's something kind of awesome. And, you know, some folks would say divine about that. So like, yeah, that really cracks open a far more profound thing than some intellectual exercise and argument, which, let me be clear, it's really fun to debate ideas intellectually. This is not to diminish that. The issue is that we have lost so much trust that doing that in good faith, with good banter and with enough grace has become too rare for us to do it at all.
You know, Monica, I know that I have had the personal experience that when I feel truly listened to, truly witness, someone is truly present, it changes me.
Yes.
You know, I've had that experience that it just really changes the whole situation. And that's what you're talking about, that deep listening. Mm-hmm. If we've ever had that experience, then it's easier for us to give it to another.
Yes, exactly. People need to be heard in order to hear. People can only hear when they're heard across divides. And that's the key. That's the way to unlock each other. Even the most recalcitrant person, there's a kind of courage and patience. You know, some people, it's going to take a lot of listening and genuine demonstration of interest for them to believe it long enough to open, right? So some folks, it takes a little more time. But I am someone who believes that it can happen with anyone. Curiosity is a gift, right? When a friend or even a stranger is, you know, sees, for example, the glow on my face because something good happened to me that day and takes the time to go, how are you doing? What's going on? Oh, what happened? Tell me more. That sounds really cool. You know, you start to just like blossom like a flower that somebody is even paying attention to you. And what their questions and their witnessing helps you understand yourself. Like,
right.
what a tremendous gift that is. Exactly. And as a journalist for so much of my career, I've seen that. That's one of the reasons I'm a journalist, because I love seeing people blossom when questions are directed from a place of fascination, from a place of I want to join you in discovering what makes you interesting. The payoff can be tremendous, but yes, in the moment, boy, even if you intellectually agree with all of this, like, oh, everything she's saying sounds fantastic. It's like applying it in the heat of the moment is another question entirely. For me personally, one of the places I struggle with the most is interrupting people. I am an extrovert, if you can't tell. I enjoy expressing myself. And so sometimes I'm a loud listener. So when someone else is talking, I go, oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, me too. Blah, blah, blah. You know? And if I'm not careful, even that kind of positive interruption can take the spotlight away and then pull it back to me. And that's not what I meant. But sometimes I just plain interrupt because I just couldn't listen for more than 30 seconds. So I'm working on, hold that, hold it. Let them keep talking. If I want to jump in with my opinion, force myself to ask one more question, at least one, and make it a curious one. And I always am glad I did.
How lovely. And I know that you love to get people to tell their stories rather than their political views, to go into storytelling. And there's a quote by Muriel Rukhauser, who is a poet and political activist. And she said, "The universe is made up of stories, not atoms." I love that quote, because that's what you are really emphasizing, that if we can get into people's stories of how they got to where they are, then it really is very helpful in receiving what it is that they know and why they know it.
Yes. And I love that you mentioned the word receiving, because I think reception is the thing to work on. You know, Our society talks a lot about the freedom of expression, and boy, have we experimented with expression. We don't hold ourselves up to such a high standard of reception. What does it mean to shape ourselves into people who can not only share our convictions, you know, with fearlessness, but receive other people's convictions with fearlessness too, even if they're contradicting our own convictions? Because how can we expect people to extend us that reception if we can't extend it to them?
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Sometimes in these empathetic dialogues, to go deeper and to research more deeply my own feelings about all of this and my own perspective in lieu of all these different facets.
Yes. Yes. Wow. Yeah. I mean, what resonates with me on that is all the times that I have gone to places that are outside my comfort zone, discursive spaces. Those are the places where you'll encounter something familiar, but framed in a whole new way. And the benefit that gives our intellect and our hearts and souls, it's literally all it is just looking at the same thing from a different angle. Try it on. You don't have to keep it. You don't have to marry it. Try it on. What happens? What thoughts get sparked? What new constructions start to complicate, you know, however you used to see something? I tend to believe that the more of those lenses we can collect, the more of those, you know, literal like eyepieces we can like pick up from someone else and look through and look through and look through. Something about all that layering of those lenses tells me, I think that's how we get closer to a deeper kind of truth.
Exactly, exactly. I'm speaking with Monica Guzman, and she is the author. I've never thought of it that way. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, moniguzman.com, and she spells it Moni, M-O-N-I. G-U-Z-M-A-N, moniguzman.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Open dialogues across partisan places, and this is really difficult. And, you know, I would love for you to talk about the complexity of where we are living these days. Because I think that there is a tendency to want to simplify things and say, okay, it's black or white, either or. But you really say complex issues cannot be fixed or resolved with either or thinking. So I'd love for you to talk about the complexity in which we're living.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of remarkable. The world is and has always been so complex. What I think is really special about the time we're in is how difficult it is to hold that complexity and leave it complex. Psychologists have for decades researched this process where, because uncertainty when we are anxious is so difficult to hold, what we do is something that they term manufacturing certainty. We will scan, we will find an answer. Doesn't have to be a particularly good one, but it sounds confident. It's got a statistic or two, and maybe it's a thought piece on the internet, and we'll grab it and we'll say, ha-ha, this is why 70 million people did a thing. I don't need to ask any more questions. I already know all of them and all of their motives. So it's less that we don't see that complexity is, of course, all around us, or that we don't acknowledge that. And it's more that it's just extremely uncomfortable to hold because we have a sense of threat. We have a sense of fear and anxiety that, you know, makes certainty just a lot more soothing.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And I'm thinking that we've been trained to just erase all inconveniences, mm-hmm. you know, that we don't want to be in conflict. And so mm-hmm. we go to that place where we feel comfortable and certain, and mm-hmm. and we kind of put fences around it. We frame it, we spray fixative on it, and we put it up on the wall and say, okay,